I'm Lilo van Tilburg for Biz News. Well, born in South Africa, Peter Bauer is the co-founder and former CEO of Mimecast, an Anglo-American company that is a leader in advanced email and collaboration security. Peter is also known for his environmental advocacy. He has purchased a mountain peak in Cape Town to establish a wildlife education program with his wife, Vicky, for underprivileged children. And Peter is joining us in the Biz News studio. So happy to speak to you.
Great. Thank you, Linda.
Well, it's so nice to see South Africans doing well. And can you walk us through your childhood and how it eventually led you to start this security company?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I grew up, my father was a high school teacher and then a school psychologist. And then he trained teachers. So sort of this education vein has run through my body for a long time. But also not having grown up in a particularly affluent household, although blessed to go to a fabulous high school in South Africa. And I guess that was part of the injustice of apartheid, but the privilege that I did have as an opportunity as a young white male South African to have a fantastic education in Cape Town, but it left me not wanting to go to university and very much wanting to figure out how to start and run a company. And you know, I thought the best way to do that is to learn a little bit from books and classes, but not go sit at Stellenbosch or UCT or something like that, but get out into the real business world and start, frankly, building a company from scratch, which I had a great privilege to do. Built a little school supplies company in Cape Town in the early 90s. And after doing that, I'd learned sort of just enough to be dangerous, and I went traveling, and I discovered this new fandangled thing called the internet by reading magazines. I don't know if you remember magazines, they're these sort of paper things that you open and picture.
Yeah.
Rossi, but I learned all about this new thing called the internet in 1995, and I came back to South Africa hell-bent on getting into tech, and did some studies and thought, I really want to have a tech company. It would be super cool, but I need to learn that business. So I went to go and work for a small system integrator. In fact, probably one of the first black empowerment system integrators in South Africa, a company called Berkie Sizwe Computer Systems. And I learned just enough there to sort of have the delusion of being ready to start my own little tech firm. So I had an early entrepreneurial experience building a software development company with a friend who'd studied computer science at UCT. And he and I built a business, and we did some amazing work with some of the corporates in South Africa. In fact, we built the very first news factory for what became news24.com. And oh, wow. I'm sure they've long since thrown our software out and replaced it with with something better. But for many years, that was the back end, and we did amazing work for Old Mutual and Saft Marine and companies like that. But we sold that company and worked for the new owners, which were a publicly listed South African company, for a few years before moving to the UK, where I was actually initially wanting to sell South African software into the UK market. But it wasn't particularly successful as a project, and after a few months, I settled into the ideas around Mimecast with my co-founder there, Neil Murray, also originally South African. We set out on that journey, and that has been the last 21 years of my life, and frankly fascinating and a hell of a ride.
So I've read that you were barely 23 when you started your first company. What we say in South Africa, you wet behind the ears.
Oceans behind the ears.
Yeah. So, you know, what gave you that oomph, that chutzpah to actually do that?
You know, I think it was partly the sense of adventure, but also the kind of this feeling of being sort of not a great employee, being sort of unemployable. I mean, I was a great employee. Let me not sort of put it that way. I'm very extremely dutiful and all of that stuff. But I didn't particularly enjoy having to work on other people's terms. And it's probably a shortcoming in general, but it was just enough of an impetus to say, well, if you could do something your way. And if you could shape a company and kind of express yourself through building something that's, you know, with your people, with your culture, with your values, go out and do it. And I think having learned from the little school supplies company, sort of what the art of the possible was, I had a sense of the process. So it was less intimidating to me, the idea that, you know, things would start really small and fragile, and you just show up every single day and you lay another brick and you figure out another thing. And I fell in love with that process. So I really wanted to get back and to be able to do it in tech, which just, you know, felt like such an exciting industry and really is an exciting. I mean, software, I think Bill Gates said it's the closest thing that we have to magic. Was a fascinating opportunity to get started again.
Well, why would you walk away from the CEO post at Mimecast?
Well, you know, I've been in the CEO post for 21 years, and I think I've gotten so much from playing that leadership role in the company, and I've enjoyed it greatly, and at the same time, given a lot of myself, and sometimes that's also a little bit at the expense of other areas of one's life. And I think, you know, you reach sort of a certain age, and I just turned 50, and I'd thought about it for a while and realized I'm not going to be the CEO of Mimecast forever. You know, where's the best point to hand over the reins and perhaps contribute in a different way to the future of the company? And my agreement with myself was, it's not so much about when, but it's about who. And, you know, do we have, and obviously having taken the company private, we had a little bit more flexibility, we had a little bit more privacy in terms of how we approached this. And I have a fantastic partner in Permira, the private equity firm, in terms of collaborating on this process. So we were able to be really thoughtful about it, but I was really committed to making sure that when we had a stunning candidate to take over, that would be the time. It wasn't a case of me running out and sort of, because there's lots of people arguably who are capable of the job, but this is a special company, Mimecast, and we wanted a special leader with just the right attributes, and I think we're really blessed to have Mark. So Mark's availability, that was tick box number one. And then the second thing that I've always believed, because, you know, companies go through good times, they go through tough times, and there's always a little bit of both going on, you know, frankly, particularly in a company of our size. But I felt very strongly that if we were in any sort of crisis, that would not be the time to step away. And our company has had crises. We've had setbacks over the years. You always feel like quitting during those times, but it's most important that you don't. And, you know, when things are going really well, you feel a lot less like stepping away. You want to stay on the ride for a while. But it's important to recognize that is the time, that when you've got the right person and the company's at a point where it's not dealing with any major setbacks. And so that sort of magical intersection happened, and I feel really fortunate to be able to support Mark now as the new CEO and see the company go to the next level.
But you're still involved. You'll still be on the board. What else are you going to do now?
Yes. Well, I am here. I keep reminding Mark now, I work for him as a board member. I'm here to support him, and I'm rooting for the company. I love the company. I love the people of the company. And our customers are, we have amazing customers. So we're really committed to doing a great job for them. But it is fabulous to have flexibility in my day, to have conversations like this, Linda, and to spend time with friends, to spend time with family, to spend time. And I'm only 5 weeks into this, so I don't have a perfect sight. I've been reading some books and catching up on. You don't get to watch television much when you're a CEO of something. So I was recommended to me by somebody to watch this TV program called The Bear. Which I've been watching and really enjoyed it. It's actually quite a masterclass in leadership and transformation, even if the setting is this sort of dingy Chicago restaurant. But it's giving me an opportunity to sort of think a little bit more broadly, and I'm enjoying that. And we can talk about what some of those directions are as well. I know you've kept a little bit close to some of our projects.
Well, you talked about a masterclass from Bear. I think a lot of young entrepreneurs would like to get one from you. What kind of advice would you give a young entrepreneur?
Don't do it.
No, I'm fortunate.
You know, I think building a business is such a fantastic thing. It's such a challenging thing, but it is, I've said this before, it is such a great form of self-expression. It is like painting a picture. And the bigger the business grows and the bigger it becomes, the bigger the canvas is that you have to paint on. And that's, you know, if you ask an artist, you know, what do they want to paint a picture? You know, they might look for a canvas that's, you know, 60 centimeters by, you know, 50 centimeters. And then if you show them one that's, you know, a kilometer by a kilometer, they sort of might get nervous. But the canvas grows over time. And it's an opportunity to really, it's a hard thing because your shortcomings get exposed to you as you're painting and creating. There's no ways to cover an enormous canvas on your own. You have to bring a team together and create something together. But it's a beautiful thing. And when you see others able to participate in it and you see your leadership and coordination role having a positive impact on other people's lives, and you see the capabilities that they develop in the process as you start co-creating something, it's great. So I would encourage young entrepreneurs to just embrace that journey. I mean, it is going to expose you to some, and it did to me, some incredible learning opportunities, and probably take one to a point where one's so fatigued of learning things that you almost want to stop. You can't bear it anymore. Like, I remember being at a point in 2014 and being in New York City with my CFO at the time. And, you know, we were trying to figure out about taking the company public. And I just said to him as we crossed this busy road, I was like, I just don't want to learn anymore. I don't want to learn this stuff. Like, like, can't we just keep running the business the way we have? Why do we have to do this? It was like it was my inside voice coming out, and I trusted him, and he was a tremendous colleague. And I remember expressing that, and then, you know, and then we got to the other side of the road, and I was like, wow, we're going to do it anyway. So stop complaining, figure it out. And it is about gathering other folks around you that have expertise. You don't have to do it all yourself. You don't have to learn it all yourself. But leading that journey, that's a great privilege as an entrepreneur.
Well, let's talk about you being an eco-warrior now. So why this commitment that you made in Cape Town, first of all, and generally, you know, to save the environment?
Yeah, well, I mean, save the environment, it sort of sounds grandizing, but
sorry.
When you say warrior, I think let's say warrior as in sort of concerned, as opposed to some sort of Shaka Zulu kind of warrior image. Yeah, so you know, I think as a family, we're obviously very fortunate from the business success to be the custodians of some resources and to be able to think about, you know, how do we apply those? Again, a form of self-expression, philanthropy. It's self-serving in some senses. So again, I don't want to aggrandize it in that sense, but it is a great, like leading a business, having the resources to apply to projects. And so we think a lot about two things. We think about social justice and we think about environmental justice. And in particular, where those things overlap is a great intersection that we can, you know, we can get double the impact. We also think about supporting entrepreneurs that are working in those fields, whether they're social entrepreneurs or folks working in startups that are looking at things that can have positive environmental impact, like, you know, replacements for single-use plastic, road building materials that are no carbon or not fossil fuel based, innovations in the wind energy industry, innovations around agriculture to help things like first mile traceability in the cocoa industry. So we have a number of really interesting projects that are, you know, probably for-profit type organizations. There may be B Corps and so on, but those are sort of investments that have returns in multiple directions. When it comes to sort of the environment and social justice, I think South Africa has many opportunities, and we've been able to scratch the surface on some. So almost by accident, we landed up with this mountain because it was the previous owner. I think the fellow had inherited it, and he wasn't sure. He sat on it for a very long time and was entirely negligent in removing alien invasive species. And obviously that presents a major fire hazard. So this thing came on at auction, and we were kind of the only bidders, and in dollar terms landed up with a very small investment owning this mountain thing in South Africa, and thought, okay, well, we're sort of like the dog that caught the speeding car. What do we do now? But we had this sort of gentle process in the background that the Cape Kids Foundation, which is you know, a big part of our philanthropy and my wife's work with her team in Cape Town, which is as you know, Linda, you've spoken with a trauma aware education program for kids in the Cape. And you know, we thought there may be some good overlaps in terms of these kids being able to be involved in and have awareness of you know, what it takes to take care of some part of nature. And so that opportunity exists. Obviously, step one was we got to clear all this alien vegetation, and that's cost an extraordinary amount of money that wasn't entirely planned, but it's our duty to do that. You know, we've had to deal with interesting curveballs like fires in the area. And, well, thank goodness we cleared the alien vegetation, because I think that seriously, presented something of a large-scale fire break. but we're interested in that. We have a few other conservation-related efforts that we're involved with in South Africa. And also looking at opportunities to expand that. I'll be taking my son to see some of the African bush next month, which I'm really excited about, and so it's an important connection for us.
Well, after Boston, I don't blame you. Boston winters are quite tough.
Yeah, well, if we keep going with this climate change stuff, I think Boston winters might rival Cape Town summers, unfortunately.
You said you are involved in other projects in South Africa. So are you keen to be part of a change agent in South Africa, if I can call it that?
Yeah, well, I think change is constant in the world. And it's not about sort of trying to disrupt anybody's anything. It's about recognizing that the more committed you are to positive progress, that's a good thing. And unfortunately, a lot of society's development has been at the expense of things like social justice and at the expense of things like sort of good environmental practice. And, you know, we're having to sort of relearn how to apply our talents as a species to take better care of each other and to take better care of the planet. And, you know, that may not be the sentiment of every member of the human race, but there's an opportunity for some of us to think that way and to apply what we have and the time that we have to do that and to make it as contagious as possible. So, you know, I always say, you know, there's so many problems out there, and frankly, none of us are capable of solving those problems, but we're all capable of chipping away at them. And maybe if by some luck or magic or confluence of events, the collective chipping away at them changes the outcome and moves us in a better direction for future generations and even for, you know, current generations, that would be awesome. And it just feels like time and money well spent.
You've recently in Boston hosted Museum of Mommy. So are you keen on getting politically involved, or may I ask you about that meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I can barely spell the word politics, so I'm not particularly that way inclined. However, two things. The one thing I have learned is that lawmakers and those that control expenditure decisions on behalf of countries can have an outsized impact on outcomes. And so, you know, having lived up, probably grown up, pretty much as a private sector sort of bigot, I've come to learn, especially spending time in Massachusetts with both public and private sector leaders, that public sector and learning a little bit about U.S. politics, public sector has an enormous impact on outcomes through policy, through budget decisions. It dwarfs what private sector can provide innovation, but really the direction of travel is set by policymakers, and so it does matter. It matters a lot more than I think many business people, and certainly me as a business person, had appreciated historically. So I would say that sort of draws me to want to sort of at least understand or communicate with folks who are in that position and contribute what I can. And then secondly, in terms of you know, people like Musi, I think I'm always interested in people that can be great ambassadors for South Africa. And we have an incredible country. We have some incredible talents and people that are willing to be ambassadors for the country in a positive sense and build bridges and relationships. Like, I'd love to be as supportive as possible. And so, you know, when I heard Musi was visiting DC, I asked him, would you come to Boston and just spend a little bit of time with some friends and connections over here? And he agreed to do it. And so we were very fortunate to have him meet with quite a few people across public and private sector, some very prominent African-American leaders in this area. And I think he found the experience inspiring towards his own leadership journey. But I can tell you, he was such a remarkable ambassador for the country. A message of hope, a rejuvenation of Nelson Mandela's vision for the country, and that was powerful. And I mean, frankly, I'd love to have other leaders from South Africa that are interested in the connection. There's deep connections between Boston and South Africa that go back, into the dismantling of apartheid and some central characters. In fact, Nelson Mandela's was the first city he visited internationally, and he danced here at the Charles River with 250,000 Bostonians who were out to see him. So I know Donald Trump likes to boast about the size of his crowds, but I think Nelson Mandela may have I've heard some people have said may have outdone Donald Trump in crowd size there. So
Can I ask you a provocative question? Often when people refer to people like you who've been successful, South Africans who've been successful overseas, talk about the billionaire South Africans. Does that label irk you?
Well, it does, mainly for mathematical reasons, because there's no justification for our exchange rate being like where it is. And I would love the math not to spit out that number, frankly. So, you know, South Africa has such an opportunity in terms of the people, the natural resources, the infrastructure. There's so much to build on there. And I think this was one of Musi's key messages to folks over here, which was it doesn't take a lot to ignite that for great progress. But one has to... one has to have leadership that's committed to that and committed to service. Leadership is a service industry. It's best thought about as an industry, but it's best thought about as a service industry. And I think there's a way to get the South African economy to be magnificent, with tremendous growth, but good growth that's inclusive, growth that brings vibrancy and prosperity to many people, but also growth that's environmentally responsible and is kind of well thought out. You know, I think South Africa 20 years ago was really on the cusp of being this incredible example to the world. And you know, that can be reclaimed. I think a lot of people remember that. In fact, many people are not aware necessarily of some of the challenges. We may be able to leapfrog over international people's expectation because they're not as aware, perhaps, as some South Africans. Or I think South Africans in the country, many are frustrated and want to know why we're struggling to figure out how we can realize our potential. But so it's not a political statement. I think there are many people who are willing to contribute. It's just I think some people have gotten confused as to what the order of priorities are, and it's, you know, it's others first.
So you remain positive about South Africa and committed to it?
Very much so. And I think it's something I learned as a South African is an unbridled optimism, because, you know, pessimism may be entirely justified, but it renders you somewhat useless. So I'd rather be brazenly or delusionally optimistic. And you learn this as a South African and as a and in business. I mean, there's no way to frankly logically justify starting a business. I mean, there are so many logical frameworks that can talk you out of it, but you see something and you pursue it anyway. And like, I don't think any successful entrepreneur didn't at some point use a form of delusion to get from here to there. And of course, you can't see that anymore because it all makes perfect sense in retrospect once it's worked. Of course, most businesses don't work, and so the delusion is sort of caricatured. But successful companies were also a product of delusion at a point. And so I don't think it's particularly an objective decision to be optimistic, but it is the best position to take. And frankly, I think there are many objective ways to do the math to go, like, it's an amazing country with amazing resources, with amazing energy, amazing people, an amazing history of having transformed. And there's a lot to take. But, you know, again, we have real issues we have to confront and figure out, you know, how are we going to address those and how are we going to move forward. And that's hard.
Well, we can't have a cybersecurity expert asking something for the business community to take away on the cybersecurity space. I've looked at your latest report, a cybersecurity report you released, mentioning that you've blocked something like 215 million attacks in January. So is cybersecurity threats increasing for the business sector?
I think they are. And the whole market is going through a pretty dramatic change. I mean, people who close to it are very aware, but you just have to look at what's going on with NVIDIA's stock price and, you know, even Microsoft's, frankly. And just like the arrival of the internet, the arrival of AI is going to be disruptive. And ultimately, I think, positive and yield great results. But it's another form of change that businesses and society is going to have to grapple with as machines take a big leap up in terms of capability to do kind of cognitive activities. And with that come potentially some tremendous productivity advantages for adversaries who are going to be pioneering, just as much as you've got folks looking to use this technology for good to cure disease and solve, you know, resource allocation and other sort of problems, and there will be people who are looking to derive ill-gotten gains from this technology. And so the cybersecurity sector remains vitally important as innovators to work out how do we head these things off, and how do we work in a safer way, because we have to be able to trust our digital infrastructure. We have to be able to trust our digital applications. And we have to be able to trust these digital representations of every... Like, we don't sign contracts on paper anymore. We sign digital representations. It's fantastic. It's very efficient. Like, you and I have never met in person. I'm relating here, and you're relating here to a digital representation. And we're very confident we're actually talking to each other and you exist. But there's no particular reason why that is true in the age of generative AI. And so establishing trust, and I know this is a huge part of Mindcast's work, is how do you retain trust in the digital representation of things in a predominantly digital workplace? And it's going to be an increasing challenge.
Peter Bauer, the co-founder of Mimecast, thanks so much for speaking to us. That was so interesting.
Thanks, Linda. Yeah, I enjoyed your questions, and it's always fun to talk about a variety of different topics like this.